Welcome back or to the Sleep Research Society podcast. My name is Jesse Cook, and I serve as host of the Sleep Research Society podcast, which is purposed to disseminate and discuss the latest findings in sleep and circadian science. Before diving into today's episode, it is critical for me to emphasize that the views expressed in this podcast are solely those of the individual being interviewed and do not reflect the views of the Sleep Research Society or its affiliates. Also, this podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be taken as medical advice. If you believe you have a medical problem, please speak with your doctor. Here is an orientation to the topic of focus for today's episode. Light detected by the retina regulates and modulates a multitude of physiological processes, including those related to sleep and the circadian timing system. It is thought that these effects are primarily mediated by specialized retinal ganglion cells that contain the photopigment melanopsin and are intrinsically sensitive to short wavelength light between 460 and 480 nanometers. As such, these are referred to as intrinsically photosensitive retinal ganglion cells, or IPRGCs. Activation of IPRGCs through short wavelength light results in upregulation of melanopsin, which in turn leads to melatonin suppression. Previous research has consistently showcased that acute light exposure in the evening, particularly those with large blue light short wavelength proportions, can have a significant impact on perceived sleepiness, sleepability and quality, and alertness upon awakening. Specifically, research has clarified that short wavelength light exposure in the evening can reduce sleepiness, degrade sleep initiation abilities, and reduce objectively measured slow wave activity during the first sleep cycle, with the negative influence on sleepability and quality resulting in increased morning sleepiness. It is believed that the light exposure not only influences physiology during the actual exposure, but also that there are residual impacts from the alerting effect of light during the sleep period. Beyond IPRGCs, there are other photoreceptors, including short wavelength, medium wavelength, and long wavelength cones, as well as rods, that serve a critical role in mediating vision and thus are thought to be a player in the mechanism underlying the physiological effects in response to short wavelength light exposure that in turn influence sleepiness and sleepability and quality. However, the existing literature on this topic has not teased apart the granularity of the underlying mechanism, which leaves uncertainty as to whether the activation of the IPRGCs, activation of other photoreceptors, or an interaction between IPRGCs and photoreceptors cause the changes in sleepiness and sleepability and quality. Today's episode focuses on a recently published manuscript in the journal Sleep entitled, "Melatonin Suppression Does Not Automatically Alter Sleepiness, Vigilance, Sensory Processing, or Sleep," that reviews an investigation purposed to address this gap in knowledge. In this episode, I am joined by the lead author from the manuscript, Dr. Christine Bloom, to discuss this investigation, which leveraged a novel technique known as metameric light or silent substitution to isolate the effects of evening light exposure on IPRGCs while controlling the effects on other photoreceptors. Before diving into the guest interview, here is a brief background on today's guest, Dr. Christine Bloom. Dr. Bloom is a sleep scientist working at the Center for Chronobiology of the University of Basel and its psychiatric hospital in Switzerland. Prior to this position, Dr. Christine Bloom completed a PhD in the doctoral college Imaging the Mind at the University of Salzburg, Austria. Dr. Bloom's research interests center around the effects of daylight and artificial light at night on circadian rhythms in human sleep. Additionally, Dr. Bloom is also interested in cognitive processing during healthy sleep and in patients with disorders of consciousness due to severe brain injury. Besides research, Dr. Bloom is also a sleep therapist delivering cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia at the sleep clinic of the psychiatric hospital of the University of Basel. Dr. Bloom has received numerous awards, including but not limited to the Early Career Sleep Science Award in 2020 from the German Sleep Society. Beyond this, Dr. Bloom loves science communication. For instance, Dr. Bloom has regular airtime on the Sunday program of the German public radio, with these efforts culminating into the Science Communication Award of the German Psychological Society in 2022. This is also evidenced by their graciousness to take time out of their day to afford to the SRS podcast. So, without further ado, here is my interview with Dr. Christine Bloom, unpacking their publication in the journal Sleep, entitled "Melatonin Suppression Does Not Automatically Alter Sleepiness, Vigilance, Sensory Processing, or Sleep." Hope you enjoy. And now for the interview portion of today's episode. Dr. Christine Bloom, welcome to the SRS podcast. It is a true privilege to digitally sit down with you. I haven't had the opportunity to meet you in person yet, so I feel blessed that the SRS podcast gave me this opportunity, as many of my close colleagues have actually raved about you and your personality. So I feel very blessed to have the opportunity to interview you, and thank you, of course, for finding the time to discuss your research, especially at the end of a work day on a Friday. So thank you for squeezing that in. How are you doing today?
Hi, thank you. The pleasure is all mine. I'm doing fairly well. It's been an exhausting week, but I was looking forward to the podcast recording, and I'm still awake. I just had a cup of coffee before we started. So yeah, all good.
Wonderful. Well, I'm certainly looking forward to what should be a very enlightening conversation, just to set the stage with an awful pun there related to light. But before we dive into anything research related, you know, I have some really, really important questions for you, Christine. First off, do you have any big plans for the weekend at all?
Not so much. So tonight I'm going to meet some friends, and then actually I really need a weekend just for myself and to wind down a little. But yeah, on Sunday I'm going to go hiking with a friend, which is something I love doing and which gives me lots of energy for the time and talks to come.
I love it. Well, I will hide my jealousy. Hiking is one of my favorite hobbies. But living in Madison, Wisconsin, we have what I call glorified hills. We do not have mountains. So I like to think of them more as nature walks rather than hikes. Still very recharging and refreshing and enjoyable. But I miss big mountains. So I will live vicariously through your excellent hike this weekend. And prior to starting this interview, the way the episodes are set up, I give the listeners kind of an orientation to the topic and also a brief background into our guest, you. Thank you for sending over those materials to help with the biography there. But I always think it's really helpful for the listeners in particular, and also very enjoyable for the listeners, to have the guests kind of tell their story. So, Christine, before we go any further, can you please tell us about kind of your journey to this point in sleep and circadian research?
So when I finished my studies, I wanted to do a PhD, and I wanted to work with patients suffering from disorders of consciousness following severe brain injury. So I was not interested in sleep, I have to admit. But then I ended up at the University of Salzburg and in the lab for sleep and consciousness research, which has the sleep in its name already. And I remember that at the beginning of my PhD, I always said, well, sleep, that's what the others do. I do consciousness research. But then, of course, I got in touch with sleep as well. And you can also think about sleep as a state of altered consciousness in healthy individuals. And so that's how I got into sleep research. Then when I was thinking about what to do for my postdoc, one of the reviewers for my PhD thesis was actually Christian Kajochan, so the head of the Center for Chronobiology here in Basel. And he said, well, wouldn't you be interested in coming over and doing a postdoc with us? And then I said, well, yes, sure, why not? But then it was clear that at the Center for Chronobiology, I would probably do a bit more sleep and circadian or chronobiology research. Yeah, I've developed a project and I applied for it and it got funded. And so I ended up here in Basel at the Center for Chronobiology. And since then, I became more and more a sleep researcher and, of course, also circadian rhythms researcher. And I also have to say that probably me doing quite a bit of science communication also helped me develop into that direction. Because when you talk about sleep, then you also discover so many interesting aspects about it, that sleep becomes an important part of your identity, or that's at least what happened to me, yeah.
Beautiful. Well said on many fronts. And, you know, I still think it's so strange. I have like a smirk that comes on my face when I separate sleep and circadian research, or when I talk about sleep and circadian health in that manner, because they're truly inseparable. And so I think we need to have a better word that just like sleepcadian or something like that, that just blends them together. Because they truly are inseparable. And it's interesting. Dreams in the subconscious were kind of my pull into sleep and sleep research in general. But it wasn't really until I came to the University of Wisconsin that I realized that people were using sleep as a lens into consciousness. And a lot of the work being done by Chiara Sorelli and Giulio Tononi, I imagine, align with some of the stuff that you were very interested at first. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, exactly.
Are you still doing any of that research today, or have you fully kind of transitioned?
Not myself at the moment. I mean, not in terms of hands-on, because you always need a bit of infrastructure or, say, collaborations. And I just don't have these collaborations here in Basel. You need to set those up, and that can be quite time-consuming. I still do collaborate with the University of Salzburg, though, and specifically also Monika Angerer, who's been my first PhD student I was allowed to supervise. Actually, she's also a really good friend of mine. And yeah, we've had and still have this wonderful collaboration where we also, in patients suffering from disorders of consciousness, where we looked into whether light therapy, so using solutions that cause the daylight to vary dynamically in the patient's room as compared to just a habitual light, whether that improves circadian rhythms and perhaps thereby also the clinical state of these patients. So I'm still interested in it, and I'm still doing it to some extent, but not hands-on.
Very cool. And who knows, maybe you'll circle back in a more focused effort later on, right? That's yeah. The beauty of research is
we... I was about to say this, yeah.
Yeah, doors always are slightly open, right?
Exactly.
Listeners can't see, but there's a nice analogy there to the back, or a metaphor, since my door in the background is slightly ajar for the cat. So the cat can go into its room and not bug me and disrupt this podcast, of course. And I can only imagine, just based on my brief, 15 or so minutes pre-show here talking with you, and just the exchange back and forth on Twitter and emails and things like that, that you are an exemplary mentor when it comes to a graduate student mentor. So I again am going to have to hide my jealousy, and I'm certain that is it your past current graduate student, or
she's graduated in July, so it's a past graduate student. Yeah,
well, your past and your future. We're very lucky on that front.
I'm blushing now. People can't see that.
This is why we only do audio.
We need to promote kindness in research, because often what we do, it's difficult. It, you know, it puts us under pressure. We're devoting so much time, so we should at least be kind with each other.
That's a as far as a goal, a good minimum goal to have, right? And a good theme to leverage across not just our relationships in science, but relationships across the board. But you're absolutely right, and it's I think becoming more the norm, but I think there's still a lot of barriers that inhibit just compassionate, empathetic discourse in the empirical setting, and so much of it is, I think, job related. You know, we're all fighting for promotions, tenure, these academic tracks that are tied to an ego, that my research program progresses and yours kind of dies, right? And that sets up, it's not going to lead to the healthiest of communications between people. But I'm glad there are those out there, including yourself, that truly believe in the kindness of relationships and that the best quality science will come from that. But when you're not advancing the frontier of sleep and circadian research or progressing the skills of the next generation of sleep and circadian researchers, what is it that Christine does in her spare time?
As you, I love hiking. I either go to the Swiss Alps, which are real mountains, but then we also have the Black Forest nearby, or the Jura, it's called. So some smaller mountains, but I'd still consider them mountains already. So I love that. I go running on a regular basis. I just need that to clear my mind. And I play the cello in the orchestra of the University of Basel. So I love doing that too.
There is this weird symmetry going on between every guest that comes on here and the fact that they proficiently play a musical instrument. I think this will be the fourth or fifth episode in a row. And I just wonder, is it's got to be something between just science, creativity, and music in general that draws people to having kind of interest in both those spheres and skills in both those areas. Do you think that your science skills pull you into music? Do you think your music skills help your science skills? Are they completely mutually exclusive?
I think neither nor. I think it's, you know, when I started studying, and then you, of course, you have your peers, but then if you move at the age of 30, for example, it doesn't necessarily become easier to meet people. And the orchestra in particular, because any university has a university orchestra, and that's a great place to meet people. You have this common interest. So first of all, it's a social thing for me. But then also, I sometimes feel that, you know, in my job, I do have a lot of responsibility. I have to make lots of decisions, sometimes not even feeling sure myself whether it's the right one or the wrong one. And then in the orchestra, I'm by far not the best cellist in the orchestra. But it's okay that way. So I like to blend in. I like to be part of something that in the end is more than each individual part. So I like not carrying that full responsibility, but rather blending into a group of 12, sometimes 13 people and just producing something together that is more than every single person can produce.
Beautiful. And the kind of equanimity, or I guess kind of balance, not just in your life, but kind of in your psychological state, really is radiating through. And it just brings a lot of happiness and joy to my life. And I'm sure this will turn into just a wonderful conversation then. And as I said pre-show, just the tip of the iceberg for our professional relationship as well and personal relationship. Thinking about personal things and professional things, I guess, actually more so. If you weren't doing what you're doing, if you weren't a sleep and circadian researcher, again, sleepcadian, whatever word we're going to use going forward.
Sleepcadian, I like that.
Then what career would you choose?
So when I started studying, I decided between psychology and medicine. So I might just be a medical doctor. Perhaps also working on sleep, we don't know. I think today when I talk to my friends and it's about maybe the next grant not working out, of course for me one option is to go into science communication on a more professional level. That's my plan B, or also focusing a bit more on cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. That would of course also be an option. And then an option that, you know, if that fails or I don't want to do this anymore, then I might just open a hut in the mountains and invite people with sleep problems up there and we work together on this. So I have to say in my lab, we're quite a few people who love going to the mountains and we always think about a grant idea or an idea for a grant, which will give us the opportunity to buy a hut and have a sleep lab in the Swiss mountains. We haven't really come across an idea that will win us a grant. So if you have any ideas or the listeners, let me know.
Honestly, I'm happy to contribute. I'm happy to collaborate on that. That sounds like a fantastic way to, in some ways, improve various forms of our validity to, whether it's you know, taking people out into like the real world environments. And it makes me just think of Ken Wright's work and kind of the seminal work of taking people out into nature. And look, our problems are gone, right? It's healing. It's healing on so many levels. It's not just the removal of poison and toxin of social media and electronics and those types of things, but it's the enrichment through the additives and living more in line with kind of our biology and evolution and the priming. And I just get such warm fuzzies anytime I'm near a mountain. It's such a grand thing, right? And so it just shapes perspective. It's like staring out at the ocean. Mm-hmm. You just come back and you feel so much more different. So I'm happy to be a postdoc in your hut in the future. I'll put that out there now, and I'll start looking for funding sources to make that a thing.
Although I have to admit that my latest research project is on hiking and daylight exposure. So it comes pretty close to that already.
Very groovy. Very, very groovy. To kind of transition us more into an actual empirical discussion on the manuscript itself, and I will apologize to listeners out there for being a little bit congested or nasally today. I'm still overcoming a non-COVID-related illness. Brain's okay. The respiratory system's a little bit subpar right now. So I apologize for being a little more nasally today. But we're going to do our keyword association. No surprises here. This is a word association game with a scientific spin. So I'm just going to throw some words or throw a word or a couple words at Christine, and she will respond with the first thing that comes to mind. Christine, are you ready for the keyword association?
I hope I am.
All right. Well, you have no other choice. So
I guess so.
All right. First word here, Christine. Light.
Crucial to sleep.
Artificial light.
Sometimes detrimental to sleep.
I like that answer. Research.
Passion.
Circadian, let's try that again. Circadian timing system.
24 hours.
Roughly.
That was not very creative.
Melanopsin.
The eye.
Here's one that you and I talked about on the email chain, and I almost left it off the keyword association, but I just think it's a nice way to set the stage for our conversation too. Null findings.
Very important to publish.
Very important indeed. And I don't even like the name null findings. It's got a negative spin, and it's still important, right? And last word here, Christine, one that I think our listeners are going to be very familiar with, society at large, very familiar with, and will be at the center of our discussion today, melatonin.
Not the hormone of sleep.
Ooh, you've heard it here. All right. So we've started, we've revved our engines. Now we're going to transition to the actual general topic and the article of focus here. So as I mentioned in the introduction, today's episode is going to focus specifically on a recent investigation that you and your colleagues published in the journal Sleep, which is entitled Melatonin Suppression Does Not Automatically Alter Sleepiness, Vigilance, Sensory Processing, or Sleep. Hence the null findings. So initially, listeners, I'm going to ask Dr. Christine Bloom, Christine, to provide a 10,000-foot view of the investigation, and then we'll dive deeper into the weeds of the methodology, findings, and implications. And I'm excited that Christine also has kind of a practitioner background in delivering CBTI, as I'm certainly with this expertise in light, circadian timing, and also working firsthand with clients, I certainly want to have some conversation at the end to try and clarify what we know and what we don't know in some ways. So first off, Christine, what fueled you to perform this research? You know, what focal hypotheses, what gaps in the literature were you really seeking to address here?
Yeah, so this was a project that brought me to Basel. So I have to say that because I aimed at connecting what I had previously done, and that was a lot of research on sensory processing, or processing of external auditory stimuli during sleep. And I wanted to combine this with what people do research on in Basel, which is a lot of artificial light research, or light research in a more general sense. So I thought about how I could combine this. And then I felt that it would be very interesting to investigate sensory processing during sleep in relation to pre-sleep light exposure. Because what we know is that artificial light, particularly light with large blue proportions or short wavelength proportions, impairs sleep. So it, for example, delays sleep onset latency or suppresses slow wave sleep in the beginning of the night. But then this is rather crude because we do sleep staging, for example, in 30-second epochs, so there is nothing fine-grained about it. So what I was really interested in is looking at how pre-sleep artificial light exposure, and particularly contrasting to light conditions, one with larger proportions of blue and one with smaller proportions of blue, how that might affect sensory processing. So I thought this might provide insights into how artificial light changes sleep on a sort of meso scale, so on a more fine-grained level. That was the initial idea, yeah.
And I think that came through very well in the background as I read it. You know, it's very clear what's been done previously and some of the gaps related to the actual kind of individual role of certain kind of photopigments or rods or cones, how each one, we haven't really gotten into the granularity. As you pointed out, I really like the word crude. It's always been a, hey, this is what light does to your sleep. But like, how is, I think, the question we haven't really teased apart yet. And I think this is a really cool investigation to better understanding the kind of distinct or more granular components and what's driving the actual effects. Mm-hmm. And hey, it came from a null finding study. So clearly they have some import here, huh? Well, I think that's a great kind of overview of kind of the rationale and impetus for this investigation. And broadly speaking, as we'll dive deeper into it certainly here soon, but what sort of methodology did you employ? How did you design this study to kind of answer those questions?
Yeah, so maybe first, so we used a cognitive paradigm that allows us, and it's only, I have to say, in that paper now, only part of it has been published, but a second one will hopefully follow soon, where we dive deeper into the cognitive aspect. But we've used a paradigm that has been used and published before. It's called the so-called local global oddball paradigm. So it's an oddball paradigm. Many people might be familiar with that. You present tones and sometimes you have deviating tones in a sequence of standard tones, and then the brain responds to that with, for example, mismatch negativity. That's for the ED geeks. But what you can do, and what is really fancy and fascinating about this local global oddball paradigm, is that it's about prediction errors on two levels of complexity. So you have local deviance compared to standards, and you also have global deviance. And interested people can look that up. I'm not going to sing the oddball here now. But with this distinction between local and global effects, you can really look at how sleep, or perhaps even pre-sleep artificial light exposure, changes this processing at different levels of complexity, where the local effects also are usually there in the absence of attention, although they might be modulated by attention, waking attention, I should say. But with the global effects, at least in previous publications, having been shown to vanish with sleep. And there, for example, one idea was that when artificial light perhaps pushes the whole system to a more wake-like processing, whether we could see differences between the two artificial light exposure conditions and this global effect. as in promoting more wake-like processing.
Beautifully said. And, you know, I thought there was a lot of extremely meritable traits of the design. I mean, first off, you were able to have an acclimation night to kind of rule out first night effects of being in the lab conditions, which I thought was outstanding. And remind me, I think it was about 30 participants or so And then they underwent two other nights of in-laboratory monitoring, overnight PSGs included. They were spaced out generally about a week apart or so. Is that, I mean, COVID obviously created some complexities there. But you did a nice job, I thought, with the methodology as far as the ordering, accounting for potential order effects. And I really liked the comprehensive nature of looking at kind of pre-sleep, you know, vigilance through PVT and also sleepiness with the Karolinska scale. And then I loved the use of the oddball pre-sleep and during sleep. I thought that was really, really, really cool. And it's still something to me that is fascinating, but also like a bit wonky, is the fact that we are not fully offline during sleep. And it's unclear to me how online we really are, right? But the fact that we can do these types of things, right, to provoke some sort of physiological change that indicates some sort of sensory connection to the environment, I thought is really, really cool. And I will ask you to sing the oddball. I'm just kidding. We will not ask you to sing the oddball task or the paradigm itself. But and so largely, you know, just looking 10,000 foot view here, you have these individuals who are undergoing two different lighting conditions, purpose to kind of differentially affect the kind of melanopsin kind of photopigments. Is that kind of the gist of it?
Yeah. So the second aspect I should probably talk about when talking about methodology is, while at the core, of course, we had this local global oddball paradigm, our interventions were two light interventions. So from 1 hour 50 minutes until 50, it's always difficult to pronounce in English, a minute, so for an hour in total before sleep, we exposed our participants to an artificial light source. So it was a special custom-made display. And the two light conditions were designed so they exclusively differed in their effects on the intrinsically photosensitive retinal ganglion cells that contain melanopsin and are thought to primarily mediate the effects of light on the circadian system, and hence also melatonin suppression. So that was a nice twist, and so to say, because we added two extremely well-controlled artificial light conditions where we exactly knew what receptors they differed on, so only the IPRGCs, and also what characteristics they differed on, which is only in the spectrum that melanopsin is most responsive to.
Yeah, this approach, which we'll talk more about in a second, the metamuric methodology, or as you steered me to, which I appreciate the term, silent substitution, I had not been familiar with at all. Hand up here, completely naive. And I've been...
Me neither before I came to Basel.
It's super awesome. And I think relatively new, or at least relatively new for the integration into our scientific domain in some ways. And I think, as we'll talk about, there's a lot of other applications here, but I just had not, I didn't know we had that technology. And so that's really cool. And more or less, the idea is that these two different lighting conditions varied in kind of their, I guess, melanoptic lux. Is that fair? Yeah. And so in theory, just activating the melanopsin differentially, and we would expect in the higher melanopsin condition to have a greater suppression of melatonin than we would in the low melanoptic condition. Is that correct?
Exactly. So the fascinating aspect about this, these two metameric light conditions, is really that they allow for mechanistic conclusions, right? And we don't see that so often in sleep research or sleepcadian, you said, right? research. But really, because these two different light conditions are designed in a way to only differ in their effects on the intrinsically photosensitive retinal ganglion cells, you can really also ascribe differences, which, by the way, we didn't find, except for melatonin. But you can really ascribe differences or differential effects to this difference between the two light conditions. And that's, of course, something very nice and powerful.
I was going to say, the word powerful has got to be in there, because it's definitely a very powerful technique. And you kind of spoiled it. I also spoiled it earlier. But generally, what did you find? What did your colleagues find across the investigation? Yeah.
So it was not 100% not results. So we found that, as expected, and I was very happy to see that, because otherwise I'd probably have been in trouble. We found significant melatonin suppression by the high melanopic light. So light acting stronger on the melanopsin containing intrinsically photosensitive retinal ganglion cells. And that is important because of course, this is a manipulation check. So did the light have any effect? If it hadn't had, any other interpretation would have been really difficult, because if you don't even have effects on melatonin, well, then anything else is questionable. But what we found was this, on average, it was 14% reduction in the high melanopic compared to the low melanopic light. And then 14%, sometimes then the reviewers criticize that or asked for that also. 14% does not sound a lot. But then we have to remember that this was two light conditions that were comparable, except for the differences in the effect on the intrinsic photosensitive retinal ganglion cells. So the effects on the cones were comparable, and it was two light exposure conditions. And unfortunately, we could, for logistic and also financial reasons, we could not include a dark comparison or dim light comparison condition. But then we did find this 14% difference between the two light exposure conditions. And looking at it in a bit more detail, because I also like to be very open about the data I have, and we also have a plot on this, I think, in the supplementary data, is that we found significant suppression in 20 out of 29 participants we, after all, included. And in, 9 participants, we didn't find a suppression. I think it was 2 that there was no difference between the two conditions. And yeah, I mean, there are publications on what you need to suppress melatonin and how large the inter-individual differences there are. And there are certainly inter-individual differences. And this was a sample where, we didn't screen for maximal sensitivity or anything like this, but this was just people who volunteered for the study and who we accepted, who were healthy sleepers, et cetera. But we did not screen for specific sensitivity to short wavelength light or so. So, I had hoped for stronger effects, but I think it's still something we can work with. And then in the end, it's data that tells us something.
Yeah, it's interesting. As I've gotten more competent as a scientist through my training programs and experience and things like that, you can often read in a manuscript where somebody maybe had to address a reviewer comment. And I think there was a section in there that kind of felt like what you had just described as far as the like magnitude of reduction that, and when I was reading this, I was like, I thought 14% sounded like a lot, because honestly, we don't have a reference point. Like, I don't know how much reduction, especially in this paradigm, as you pointed out, where the conditions are comparable in many ways. So it's going to be a subtle kind of difference that we are expecting to detect to some degree. And so who knows if 14% is or is not a lot, I thought was, at least in my eyes.
And then I think, you're absolutely right that I integrated that after a reviewer comment. But I still have to say that we had extremely good comments in terms of they really helped us to improve the paper. And it was a reviewing process I really, really liked, because the comments were really appreciative. And I think it's always good if you, as an author, feel that, or also as a reviewer, feel that it's really reviewers and authors working together on improving the manuscript and the science that is delivered in that paper. And I think when I then also calculated how much or how strong the suppression is when you only look at the people that had significant suppression. And I think there we're talking about something like 30%. So it does go up, but of course, then when you have an average and you have 1/3 roughly that does not experience melatonin suppression, then you end up with something like 14. But as I said, I think it was an opportunity to be even more open about the data and really show that the individual effects and how that changed for each of the participants. Yeah, and it is an effect, you know, I always say, let the data speak. It is an effect. We need to think about why and how that came about and why maybe also it was not as strong as other people might have expected.
Well, I do already appreciate, again, the kindness that you extend to the scientific field and even the peer reviewers. I don't think that every person in our field has the same kindness for the peer review process or peer reviews they're currently a part of.
Yeah.
But I'm glad to hear that yours was productive and progressive.
Yeah. And if I may include a piece of advice for people writing reviews, I really do my best. I always try to write reviews that I would like to receive myself. And I try to be appreciative. I always try to also give authors the room to argue, because I mean, I'm not very good at mind reading, I have to admit, although I'm a psychologist. But maybe they thought about this and they came to a conclusion and made a decision based on gut reasons, which I, however, can't see. So I want also authors to convince me, but not to do stuff I say just to have it done, because I might be wrong as well.
Well said, right? And if you're not wrong today, you might be wrong tomorrow,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So I like having the humility and the open discourse and the willingness to disagree. I think these are all really important themes for science to progress effectively.
Yeah.
And we've already kind of dove in a little bit into the weeds, which I love. I love when these things kind of organically and authentically just unfold. So I want to kind of stay on this individual differences and kind of the uniqueness of some of the findings, because I too stumbled across and was kind of paramount in the, or I guess really important in the study when I was reading it, to see that, again, 20 of 29 of the participants showed a suppression. 2 out of 29 did not show a suppression between the high and low melanopic conditions. But for me, it was the 7 out of 29 showing an increase in the high condition versus the low condition.
Mm-hmm.
And you voiced how, you know, it makes sense that we're all going to have different response due to light sensitivity and things like that. But what can explain somebody having an increase between these two conditions? That was something that I just couldn't disentangle myself.
Yeah, that's true. So, I mean, what I have to say, so as you said, we had a week in between to circumvent carryover effects. We also, it was just very few, 1-2 participants where we had more than 1 week in between the two conditions. One was definitely due to COVID. There we had a longer period in between, but for the others, it might have been a week more or so because maybe they were ill. But they always came on the same day of the week. We taught them to not expose themselves to much daylight during the day. They came to the lab to, you know, control for that, and also didn't find any differences between the two conditions when we looked at this, etc. So in general, it was very well controlled, or we aimed at very high level of control. But then, and I would have to look up again how much that increase was on average. I don't know that off the top of my head. But I would probably say there is probably some intra-individual variation also when it comes to melatonin production, even though they were on a fixed schedule. And we even excluded some participants already during the data acquisition because they did not comply with the sleep-wake schedule we put them on. But then, I mean, these are people, they live their life, and there is some variability to this. And so I think it might also be that there was just some intra-individual differences that we were not able to control for. And that might be especially the case in people who anyway are not very sensitive to short wavelength proportions and the differences in these two light conditions. So if you're not very sensitive, then I would reason that even slight differences perhaps in your sleep schedule, they might then eventually lead to an increase that is, however, unrelated to the light exposure.
Beautifully articulated. And I think the manuscript describes it as a circadian stabilization protocol.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was very, very thorough and necessary, right? Like, mm-hmm. if we're going to have these washout periods, the things that happen between that week are going to lead to somebody having a intra-individual difference when they're being assessed next time. So we may not be just capturing their biology's response, maybe capturing what happened to them across the different weeks per se. And again, this is the challenge and the complexity of these types of research, but also science as a whole, right? Mm-hmm. Is there's just so much, so many different factors that can influence what we're trying to study. And there's always that balance of internal, external, and ecological validity. And I thought your study did the best you could, really, right? Unless you're going to like have all the funding in the world to keep people in a laboratory for like a decade or whatever, right?
Yeah.
And like really do it. Obviously, we may have some ethical issues there at that point. But I thought you did the best you could. Looking back on it, do you think there's anything you could have done differently?
Yeah, I think so when you talk about melatonin, you also have to consider always that people's diet. And we did not in that study control for diet. So in the latest study, we've also included in the sleep diary that people get or fill in the evening and the mornings while they're in the study every day. We included a nutrition protocol where they have to tell us what they ate. So we might look at this if we, for example, discover abnormally high melatonin values. So in the end, we had 29 participants instead of 30 because one participant just had throughout the day even abnormally high melatonin values. Not throughout the day, but when we started measuring melatonin in the evening, well before we would expect the dim light melatonin onset, that participant already had very high melatonin values. And so we just had to say, you know, we don't know what's really going on there. But that is something that you can control for, of course, and I think it makes sense to do that.
Nicely put. And again, highlighting the complexity of it all and all the various minutiae that have to be considered when trying to tease apart, especially a mechanistic relationship, right? And I know you're very committed to good science, having appropriate power to detect effects, you know, having representative groups, not trying to put out unhelpful findings, right, and results that send people down spurious rabbit holes, if you will. Just, and I imagine that's the kind of impetus for why you kept the increased individuals in the sample to assess all the relationships. So just for the clarification, the 14% average reduction includes those that also had increases or showed no suppression.
Exactly.
Did you
exactly.
do any sort of like secondary analyses looking at just the group that had a suppression and whether there was effects on those relationships?
I have to admit I didn't, because that part would have been underpowered. I might look at it in the future, but here I really, you know, I also, the study was pre-registered, and I think this is sort of, I really like doing that, because also I think it's like, I always describe it as inviting the police into the house, because we all know those situations when you're tempted, when you're like, oh, is this an outlier? Maybe I should, let's calculate this. And then you find, you know, something becomes significant, and then you're like really tempted. But no. If you haven't pre-specified any rule for an exclusion of that participant, then you must not do it. And by the way, it can also be sometimes helpful when reviewers ask you to do that, because also that happens. And then you can say, no, I've pre-registered that study. I'm not allowed to do it. Which of course you could still do exploratory analysis, which I here didn't. But no, really, here I did not pre-specify any exclusion criteria because I wanted to have a sample, without any exclusion criteria regarding sensitivity. Because anyway, this is a study, you know, with a very specific sample where generalizability, of course, is always a question. And I think it's very difficult to generalize to other age groups, to people who are not healthy sleepers, because we screened for that using the PSQI, etc. But then I think I at least wanted to have a sample that is representative and not even specialize that more.
Well, I love your dedication to good science. I really do. And on my whiteboard over there, it says that I need to pre-register my dissertation. So I'm with you on that front. And yes, it's extra work, but it's very important. And it is, again, beneficial, as you pointed out, when you get to the peer review process and being like, this is what I specified. This is what I was going after. Yeah. But I do think there is merit to kind of exploratory analyses as well, right? That's where
of course.
Insight can come from. And as you pointed out, it's one study with one sample. You know, who knows how this translates to older adults as we go through lifespan and have differential light sensitivities and also kind of endocrine production, things like that. Who knows how this translates to other medical conditions that affect kind of visual processes, things like that as well. So not trying to resolve all the issues here, but just trying to gain better clarity. And I thought you did a great job there. Let's shift back to kind of the main methodology here. So these differential kind of metameric lighting conditions, right? Purpose to, I guess, uniquely influence melanopsin while kind of not differentially affecting the other kind of relevant players in the game, if you will. And I want to just kind of place this out here first to give us a foundation to build upon. This is from a paper in 2018 from, I'm going to butcher the name, Christine, but Manuel Spichon.
Perfect.
I got it. That's the method of silent substitution for examining melanopsin contributions to pupil control. And for the listeners out there, I had no background in any of this, so I had to try and educate myself to have some sort of a conversation here. But I thought this was a nice way to describe it, where the method of silent substitution uses pairs of lights known as metamers to selectively stimulate a given class of photoreceptors. In this case, we're targeting kind of the melanopsin, while keeping the activation of all others constant. And the paper does a really nice job kind of showcasing how we can adjust things slightly. I think in this case, basically just leveraging a higher amplitude in the melanoptic kind of frequency where it's most sensitive will produce those effects while stabilizing, not having other effects on the cones or the rods. So that's my initial foundation. Now I'll pass the microphone to Christine. What did I leave out in that very elementary description of kind of this metameric approach?
Yeah, I think it was already a really good description of the method. So, well, the basic idea is that due to the characteristics of the human vision system with the different receptors involved, we all know about rods and cones, although the rods, we have to say, are saturated during daylight viewing conditions, so we can largely ignore them. But then we have also the cones, and they come in three different types, with the L cones being most sensitive to longer wavelengths, the M to medium, and the S cones to shorter wavelengths. Now, and then, of course, we have the intrinsically photosensitive retinal ganglion cells that contain melanopsin with its peak spectral sensitivity at between 460 and 480 nanometers. And due to their characteristics, we can, say, construct or calculate two different light conditions that only differ in their effects on one specific photoreceptor. Now, that means that, for example, you can have two different white screens. And although I have to admit, in that study, the color was slightly different, but you can, in theory, produce two white screens. So people just see white. And one contains large proportions of short wavelength or blue light, and one contains low proportions of blue light. The two types of white, they look the same. And that is really, really cool because as we said before, gives it a very powerful tool where it can really isolate the effects on one specific photoreceptor. And that is not limited to the intrinsic and photosensitive retinal ganglion cells, but you can do the same for example, S cones or M cones or L cones, right? So you can do that, and that will allow you to draw conclusions regarding the effects of a very specific light type on whatever variable you look at.
That's outstanding. And I'm just bewildered that this technology exists. And we've already discussed how it was applied for this study. But I'm sure that you have other thoughts of how this can be applied. So what other questions do you think you could explore using this approach, or what sort of applications of mm-hmm. this silent substitution technique do you see?
Yeah, so a real-world application might, for example, be, so many people use a night shift mode on their phones, right? And we agree that this is beneficial for many people. And although you sometimes notice the transition, usually, you know, when it's on, right, it's been on for some time, you don't notice that difference and the orange tint anymore. But still, some people don't like it. And theoretically, what you can do with metameric light is have a white screen and a white screen, but one still has reduced blue or short wavelength light proportions. So that is a real world application. But now in a current study that I'm actually doing with Manuel Spichan, because he's really an expert in this, and by the way, also great at explaining all of this to me, for example. In that current study, what we're doing, what we're looking at, by the way, it's a register report, which is also a really cool open science format. What we're doing is we're making use of the human mechanisms of color vision, and we're looking at two light conditions that differ in color, but not in their effects on the intrinsically photosensitive retinal ganglion cells. And we look whether color, as in, for example, night shift mode, does make a difference when we, however, keep the effects on the intrinsically photosensitive retinal ganglion cells in those two different conditions the same. Because what's important to understand is that the intrinsic and photosensitive retinal ganglion cells are secondary neurons, right? They do receive input from the rods and cones. And therefore, theoretically, it could well be that also color makes a difference, because there is a difference in the effects on the cones, unless you design it otherwise. And now what we're asking really is this difference on the cones, does that do anything that is of relevance that will lead to effects in a sample of 16 participants? But we see what will come out.
Let the data speak, right?
Exactly, let the data speak, yeah.
Do you foresee a world where this technology, you mentioned kind of the phones and the filtering there and things, where like in a smart home environment in the future, where like lighting can naturally change across the day to differentially affect kind of our photoreceptors and produce different outcomes, whether that's more vigilance or be more soporific? How do you think there's an extension there?
Well, it might be, but I always have to say I'm much more in favor of having naturalistic solutions to these problems. So of course, you know, therapy lamps might be beneficial for some people, especially now that days, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, are becoming shorter and people might slip into winter depression or seasonal affective disorder. But I much more prefer to tell them to go out and enjoy the daylight and not so much focus on what we can achieve technically. But then we've also talked shortly about me having done research with my colleague Monika Angerer on light interventions in the hospital environment. And that was patients who, you know, they cannot leave usually the hospital anymore, and they won't, never ever in their lives. And there, I think technical applications are really important, because often it seems to me that the light in the patient's room is something that we as psychologists or medical doctors completely ignore. But it's such a powerful tool. And then light interventions, they come without side effects, right? But they might really change something for the people who are in these rooms. And it doesn't necessarily have to be patients who suffer from severe brain injury, but also neurological disorders, who might not, even elderly people who might not be able to leave a building as easily as we can.
Yeah, I love that extension to the hospital setting in particular. There's definitely been more attention of late to improving those environments, because it's so strange to me that a setting that's supposed to be for healing recovery is set up to inhibit effective sleep and disrupt the circadian system with these constant lights and the disruptions for, you know, getting bio signals and things like that, or biomeasures. And obviously those have their purposes, but the light seems to be something that we can modify and we can adapt, and not just for the purpose of not inhibiting or hindering recovery, but potentially to enhance the actual outcomes. And so I love that that's a potential extension and something that's kind of top of mind there. And shifting gears a little bit, I know we talked a little bit about the 14% reduction and whether or not this is high or low. And the reality is, who really knows, right? But I think in your condition, you, or in your paradigm, participants were exposed to 1 hour of light exposure in these conditions. And that differed from the duration for some other studies that have been done in the past in kind of a similar area, right? I think some did like 5 hours or something like that. Do you think duration played a factor in these results? Or do you think if you had them there for 2-3 hours, you would still see kind of these null relationships?
It's difficult to say. Given previous results, I think, yeah, we're talking about the dosage, right? And one aspect of dosage is, of course, duration, in addition to something like intensity. Specifically, also here, I wanted something that was not entirely artificial, but I chose an hour because I thought that, you know, it might reflect what people expose themselves to when they again work. TV, then we all, again, have the distance between the person and the screen. But then maybe it's comparable to me preparing a podcast episode just before I go to sleep, because I have to hand in the preparation for review the next day or something like this. It might be about an hour. I might also well finish sometime before bed, although I have to say the 50 minutes we had in between switching off the light and participants going to sleep, that was logistically that they had to go and brush their teeth, which you can only do after last melatonin sample and all those things. So we needed this time in between. But then that's maybe also important to emphasize, we had about 60 photopic lux in both conditions, so that was comparable. And that is normal screen brightness. So also here we chose something that was comparable to what you or me would expose themselves to before going to bed. And of course, the results might be different when we choose longer times of exposure, or when we increase the intensity. And also there probably will be a publication from my colleague that will come out soon addressing that topic. So I can spoil that already a little. Very, very interesting results as well there. Well, it's difficult to predict. I'm especially not sure about also the effects on cognitive processing, although I find the idea really still very intriguing, I have to admit. But I don't know what would happen. Maybe also this processing mode during sleep, which in previous publications I also described as a sentinel processing mode, maybe that is something that is independent of what we experience before. Maybe it's rather a stereotypical thing, a processing mode our brain switches to independent of what's happened before. We don't really know. But maybe in future studies I can look a bit more into this.
Interesting. Well, I'll give you a second or a minute or many minutes upcoming to talk about the future studies that you're interested in. And I just, again, want to highlight, emphasize, showcase just the beauty of your design and the intentionality of thought that went into the design to, I think, improve the ecological validity, the desire to see, like, let's try and mimic what happens in people's real life while still trying to keep as much internal validity as possible. And I thought you did a really good job there on the balance. And it's just a game that there isn't a right answer to. But the fact that you're thinking about, like, okay, somebody comes home from work. Okay, maybe they have dinner. Maybe they have a little bit more work they want to do before bed, or maybe they're reading their tablet before bed. So what duration is a good estimation of that? And I really like that you blended that in. And I think that's a nice way to transition, I think, to our last kind of deeper dive topic, which is this real world stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Like, light has been at the forefront of kind of public dissemination, right? It's almost been fully villainized in many ways at this point. You know, the scale is really tipped that if, and it seems like the message out there is, if exposed to light at night, especially in the hours close to bedtime, it will have a negative impact on your sleep ability and quality, right? That seems to be like the central theme that mm-hmm. in any sort of news article or whatever. And mm-hmm. there does seem to be some other research coming out. And I may be wrong. I think it might be Jamie Zeitzer, and I apologize mm-hmm. if somebody else, but really showcasing that we may be a little bit more resilient mm-hmm. than we actually are describing. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I would be remiss here, given your expertise in this area, but also work as a provider, you know, working with individuals and CBTI specifically to help with sleep.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is the reality here? And I'm sure the answer is probably it's complex, right, to some degree, and something's unknown. But what do we really know about light and artificial light, especially in the hours preceding bedtime?
Yeah. So I think what we know is, and there are many studies pointing into that direction, that light, and especially light with larger proportions of blue, which have also come about by the use of LEDs, for example, because they have this specific peak in the short wavelength spectrum. I think there are many studies out there showing that it impacts on alertness or sleepiness in the evening prior to sleep, but then also impacts on sleep. There was also the study, for example, out in PNAS some years ago showing that reading on an e-reader impacts on your sleep compared to a physical book, etc. So certainly it does something to us. But then, as you say, it becomes a lot more complex, because all these studies are, of course, as our study, designed to control for as many factors as possible. But then in a real world environment, first of all, we cannot talk about artificial light at night ignoring daylight exposure. And then in our modern society, we have this combination that might be especially challenging for sleep and circadian rhythms with relatively low light exposure during the day. And I recently at a conference, someone showed a figure and said, actually, we spend about 98% of the day inside. And I mean, that is a lot, right? And when we imagine that we have evolved under the open sky as a species, then to me, it's not very surprising that does something to us and our circadian rhythms and potentially also sleep. And again, referring to the Ken Wright studies, which have shown that exposure to just a weekend of natural light during camping can sort of realign or reset your circadian rhythms. So definitely you cannot talk about the effects of artificial light at night without also including daylight. And I think when we talk about what we can change in a modern society, then we can, of course, recommend our patients to, for example, switch off electronic devices, including displays, 60 to 90 minutes before they go to sleep. But I think we should at the same time also recommend them to spend as much time under the open sky as possible. And there are studies that show that the more you expose yourself to daylight, you can actually prevent detrimental effects of artificial light at night on the circadian system and potentially then also sleep. And then I think there is a different level to this. This year is the 40th anniversary of the two-process model, which includes circadian and homeostatic factors that impact on sleep. And of course, when we talk about light, then also there is some homeostatic component to it, but it is also a circadian component. And especially in this study now, we've been talking about where we have young and healthy sleepers. They do come to the lab with a relatively high sleep pressure in the evening. They go to bed at their habitual bedtime and have been exposed to a fairly boring task before that. So they are tired. They probably also have quite a high homeostatic sleep pressure. And then the question is also a little, what is the circadian effect? Maybe melatonin suppression. So the impact on the internal biological clock. And what is the effect of the homeostatic sleep pressure? And especially in young and healthy participants, you might come into a situation where the homeostatic sleep drive just overpowers the effects of your light source and melatonin suppression. Melatonin as the hormone of darkness that helps you fall asleep.
Beautiful and well said. And yes, many celebrations and congratulations for the anniversary of the two-process model. I saw that come through.
Yay.
And another reappraisal or circle back, another paper on it that just got published. But I mean, I think it's a very elegant model. To me, it always kind of slightly undermines the psychological contribution to sleepability and quality. Yeah. And I think we'll fully agree there. And I think everyone does. And that's my concern with how we present light in society right now, or the aversion to light is, you know, when you're working with a patient, it's hard to communicate what you just described in a session, right? Like it's easier to say, like, you really want to be mindful of reducing or avoiding light prior to bedtime, rather than like, well, it's really complicated. And if you get up early and you go walk around in the sunlight and you get movement, and you send a strong circadian signal, and then midday you spend more time in it. Like, you don't often have time for that, right? So you often have to like simplify these things into very digestible, but not necessarily fully descriptive recommendations. And that can lead somebody to having a belief, right, that if I expose myself to light, my sleep quality and ability will degrade. And it will, as in
a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Exactly. And I see that's, I think, the problem there, right, is you could expose yourself, someone could be like, oh, but I got to look at my tablet to turn it off. And then they have an anxious thought. About, oh no, now I've looked at my tablet, my sleep's going, I'm going to have poor sleep. But it's actually the anxiety or the psychological effect that ends up driving the confirmatory poor sleep that they have that night.
And I would even add something else. So in addition to the effects of light, I mean, what do we use these devices for? Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, whatever. They are designed for us to have trouble switching off. And I mean, we even coined that term fear of missing out. So there is certainly something to this. And I think when you want to educate patients about a healthier use of devices, and in addition to addressing the topic of light that may be detrimental to sleep, perhaps also even more than being detrimental for sleep by delaying sleep times. And then when they have to get up in the morning, they're too tired. In addition, you also have to address that topic of, you know, these apps just being designed to keep you going and keep you scrolling and doom scrolling.
Yeah, it's unbelievable how well they've mastered the inhibition of our disengagement. They've literally looked at so many different ways. I just think of Netflix every time when I think of that. And you watch an episode and the next one already gears up to play, right? You have to like get up and make an intentional act. It should be you have to make an intentional act to play the next one.
Yeah.
But they have found a way, obviously, to benefit their product in that way. And before we go into a tirade on social media and all the modern things, I think we'll steer us back and land today. Christine, you've done a phenomenal job with this investigation, you and your colleagues, and I really appreciate you coming on to discuss it. And obviously, as you've alluded to already, there's a lot of other things that are now top of mind that you kind of hope to tackle, address, investigate at some point. So given these findings, given your kind of understanding of where things are at and the current studies you're running, what other research questions have come to mind, or where do you really want to go with this line of research?
I'm very much interested in the effects of daylight. So this is also my latest project. We're addressing more daylight than artificial light because, I think daylight exposure is something we can all improve to improve our sleep by also helping our circadian system. And then, well, it has circadian and homeostatic effects, daylight exposure, just to come back to the true process model. So this is something I'm very interested in, and which I think in the past 20 years or so, maybe we've had a lot of research since actually the discovery of the intrinsically photosensitive retinal ganglion cells, looking at artificial light and especially short wavelength or blue light in the evening. But I think it's also time to turn the coin around and look at the other side of the coin, and that is, of course, daylight. And I'm also very much looking forward to that project because in addition to daylight, we're also going to address physical activity, which is certainly also a factor that has changed greatly in modern societies. I have to cycle for 5 minutes to go to work, and I'm grateful for that. But if it was 15 minutes, that would probably be better. So, although I do get a lot of physical activity on the weekends, etc. But I think it's also something, especially because we know that physical activity is good for sleep. It's certainly something that is interesting to look at, and especially also because daylight exposure is often confounded with physical activity. So that's something we would like to disentangle. Otherwise, I think I'm still also intrigued by the topic of cognitive processing during sleep, and I don't want to be discouraged by the null findings now, and I'm grateful that they were published and the reviewers were supportive in doing so. I think one topic that has been on my mind for quite some time is also to investigate whether in patients suffering from insomnia that might be changed, sort of also as another level that we've not addressed in studies so far. This is, I think, something that will be interesting to look at too.
Very groovy and very related here. My final question here, my last question, I guess, is what I'll call it, to steal from one of my other favorite podcasts I listen to. To close down today's episode, of course, just want to thank you, Dr. Christine Bloom, for taking time out of your day, your Friday, to digitally sit down with me and talk your research. For the listeners, I'll plug Christine's Twitter in the show notes. I think that'll be the best place to reach her. But before I let you go, you've already talked about some research that you want yourself, you tangibly want to go perform, right? And that's top of mind. Let's just, you know, no barriers, no financial barriers, no time barriers, no expectations on publications, findings, anything like that. If all these were removed, is there a different sleep and circadian or sleepcadian topic or question that you would go after, or are you still staying in this lane?
I think I would still stand in this lane. Maybe really transfer. We'd like to have a dependency. Can you say that in English? I'm not sure. Yeah, dependency. Like in French, it would be dependance in the mountains, in the Swiss mountains. So a hut where we have sleep labs, and then, you know, we can all do the hiking stuff and its relation to sleep. And also I'd be very interested, and I hope that we also address that question in my latest project, the effects of nature exposure on sleep. Because we know that from neuroscientific studies that nature exposure is really beneficial for well-being, etc. It reduces stress. And therefore, I think it should also be highly relevant to sleep, particularly in the context also of daylight exposure and the effects on circadian rhythms and sleep.
outstanding. I either want to be connected to that research or a participant in that research. Happy to sacrifice my time, even without compensation, if you just want to stick me in nature and study me. And I think that's a great place to land today. So, Christine, thank you so much for joining me. Thank you so much for enriching our podcast with your knowledge and your kindness. Truthfully,
thank you so much. I'm blushing again now.
Hopefully we can, well, we'll have to capture that blessing image to have as our advertisement for the episode. You know, hopefully this is a new era of kindness in science, and we can be, we can disagree politely, I think is the way that we should look at scientific discourse going forward. And again, thank you so much for your time. I got to let you go so that you can get out of this. You can go outside, is I guess the way I want to say it.
Yeah, well, the sun is already almost setting now. It's 10 to 6 in the evening, but I'll do my best.
All right, well, we'll wrap things up. We'll kick you out the door. Thank you again, Christine, and
thanks
take
so
care.
Much for having me. Thank you.
And that concludes this episode of the Sleep Research Society podcast. Thank you very much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions for content, or ways to enhance the podcast, then please feel free to send an email to sleepresearchsocietypodcast@gmail.com. Again, that is sleepresearchsocietypodcast@gmail.com. Before officially closing down this episode, I would like to directly thank the leadership of the Sleep Research Society, as well as the board of directors for their support of this initiative. Additionally, I'd like to thank the Sleep Research Society Communications Committee for their efforts in the development and maintenance of this podcast. Also, I'd like to acknowledge the other members of the podcast team for their efforts behind the scenes. This includes Katrina Burrows and Shivani Gianni, who serve as podcast managers, as well as Dr. Mohan Dutt, who produces these episodes. Furthermore, I'd like to thank chronobiologist Dr. Rulof Hutt for graciously providing the podcast intro and outro music. Lastly, I'd like to thank the community of fantastic sleep and circadian researchers that comprise the Sleep Research Society, as well as all other listeners of this podcast. Thank you, and until next time, sleep well.